Hello, everyone. My name is Elijah David, minister of the 12th Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Sinai, 12th Hour, and the Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is January 17, 2017. Our sheep at 22,020. We will start our first service today with a song entitled, I Won't Have to Cross Jordan Alone. When I come to the river at the need of day, when the last winds of sorrow have blown, there'll be somebody waiting to show me the way. I won't have to cross Jordan alone. I won't have to cross Jordan alone. Just for God for my sins to atone. In the darkness I see, He'll be waiting for me. I won't have to cross Jordan alone. Oftentimes I'm forsaken and weary inside, but it seems that my friends have all gone. There is one thought that cheers me and makes my heart glad. I won't have to cross Jordan alone. I won't have to cross Jordan alone. Yes, for God for my sins to atone. In the darkness I see, He'll be waiting for me. I won't have to cross Jordan alone. The billows of sorrow and trouble may sweep, just for the Savior will care for His own. At the end of the journey, my soul He will keep. I won't have to cross Jordan alone. I won't have to cross Jordan alone. Yes, we're done for my sins to atone. When the darkness I see, He'll be waiting for me. I won't have to cross Jordan alone. Part 2, General Conference Special by V.T. Harter for on page 33. Again, if anyone should possibly entertain the idea that this promise of a prophet means a multitude of the preachers, then as surely as your soul lives, that one is fooling himself as badly as those misled followers of the Korah, Dathan, and Abiram fool themselves in their presumptuous thinking that those three prophetic office seekers and self-promoters were also prophets, as was Moses. Those three impostors, be it not forgotten, even claimed that the whole multitude were holy. Numbers 16, 1 to 3. But were they? And as surely as the earth swallowed them, then just so surely will all such in these days too be swallowed by the earth when it opens its mouth and takes away the flood. Revelation 12, 16. Sadly, those who would believe a lie and thus play the fool will do so, and nothing will stop them. It is to be devoutly hoped, though, brethren, that you are followers of the Elohim and of His Spirit in the truth, that you are not followers of the men or of the self. For the gravity of the issue challenges all unto the most honest thought and courageous decision. We should now, therefore, the more earnestly proceed with these concluding considerations. Since Elohim is not experimenting, and since He means just what He says, there should be no doubt in your minds that the scriptures concerning the antitypical Elijah, he who is to awaken the Seventh-day Adventist Church and to warn the latest sins of the great and dreadful day of Yahweh, makes sure that it is one person of a surety. He is to have faithful helpers, but according unto the prophet Nahum, he will greatly make use of the printing press and will scatter his message by the postage stamp everywhere as the leaves of olive. He will not care what is done with his publication, but will make sure that they find their way into all hands, laps, pockets, yards, or wastebaskets throughout Laodicea. Here is what the inspiration itself has to say concerning the prophet's means of taking his message unto the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Behold, upon the mountains, the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publishes peace, O Judah, keep thy solemn faith, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no longer pass through thee, he is utterly cut off. That's Nahum 1:15. You have it from the Yahweh, through his prophet Nahum, that the one who announces that the time has come for the wicked to be cut off from among Elohim's people, and that the judgment for the living, that as we have already seen, is the great and dreadful day of Yahweh, is about to take place, is to make the announcement of these events by his publication. Further concerning this timely truth, this meet in due season, Isaiah declares that he will be dispensed to all without their having to pay for it, without money and without price. He urges them, moreover, to stop wasting their money in the purchasing that which is not bread. Isaiah 55:1-2. That which is not inspired of Yahweh. What is Yahweh's counsel concerning the voice of the Elijah's publication? And what is the title of them? So now C.V. Theophilus actually claiming to be the Elijah of his day. And I'll tell you a little secret. He was not the Elijah as his first name, but he was in the spirit and power of the Elijah, just like John the Baptist was. And all of those that are proclaiming new truth to the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they have new truth, and they are given a commission to give it back to the church, and they are empowered with the spirit and power of the Elijah, because Elijah's time has come. And it had, and Elijah's time came in 1930, V.T. Holliff. He was V.T. Holliff in the spirit and power of the Elijah, because he sure did make an earthquake in the Adventist Church. And that's what Elijah did upon Mount Carmel that day with Ahab and the 850 false prophets. He made an earthquake. For the answer comes through Micah the prophet. Yahweh's voice crieth unto the city, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and the man of wisdom shall see thy name. Hear ye the rod, and who hath appointed it? Micah 6:9. But this is Elijah the Tishbite. When he went up on Mount Carmel that day, he took the message of the rod. And the rod simply means an authority for Yahweh's government. That's all it meant. He says, restore. He said, if Baal be God, he said, your God, or Yahweh, then serve him. But if he be Yahweh, then serve him. It says you can't serve both of them, one or the other. So he brought the rod to him. Here is a rod which speaks, and its voice, the scriptures point out, is the voice of Yahweh unto his people. And since the shepherd's rod, and look at that word shepherd, it says that Yahshua is that great shepherd of the sheep. It goes right there in Revelation chapter 1. He said, the publications of which contain the message of the great and dreadful day of Yahweh is the only rod, meaning authority for Yahweh's government, that has ever spoken. So anytime somebody comes with the message of the rod, it means that he comes with Yahweh's name, and he comes with proclaiming his government, which is the sanctuary. That's what happened at Mount Sinai. When Moses was taken up into the mount, it was the rod, the authority for Yahweh's government, that was taught to Moses. Okay? The sanctuary system, how to employ it, how to raise it up, how to establish a true worship there in the wilderness, raise up the tabernacle there in the wilderness. Okay, which the Yahweh demands all to hear. Some may call the publications offshoot, others may call them rubbish. Councils on Sabbath School Work, page 29. But the Yahweh's titles them as the rod. And his counsel is that we hear its voice. Okay, in the truth, since the rod is a symbol of the authority, correction, and deliverance, then what other title could more fittingly signify that it is to deliver the penitent and to do away with the impenitent? It was the shepherd's rod that freed ancient Israel, and the Yahweh has chosen the shepherd's rod to deliver modern Israel. It was the rod that led the first Exodus, and it is now seen that a rod is making ready to lead the second Exodus, Isaiah 11:11, Micah 7:14-15, Ezekiel 20:36 and 37. Now that we have heard what the scriptures say on the subject, let us next hear what the founders of the Seventh-day Adventist denomination had to say in their day. But was the prophecy wholly fulfilled in John the Baptist? For we answer no, for it is more intimately connected with the great day of the Yahweh than was the mission of John. His work had exclusive reference to the first advent, but the prophecy must relate more especially to the second advent, which is the crowning event of the ushering in of the great and dreadful day of the Yahweh, Review and Herald, February 23, 1864. Now we are told that the second advent had its origin in 1844. And indeed it did. Started the judgment of the dead. But that second advent was Yahshua coming to the temple. In heaven. He wasn't in the temple until 1844, and he came to the temple on the Day of Atonement. There in 1844. Adventists pinpointed that day to be on the 22nd day of October. So that's the second advent of Yahshua coming to start the judgment. But he didn't come visibly to the earth. He just transferred from the Father's great white throne, where he was had his office with the Father and the sides of the north, he just transferred from there to the heavenly sanctuary where they have the sacrificial offerings at, where they perform the ceremonial services of the sanctuary. And he entered that as the high priest to make an atonement for the dead, those that had their names in the Lamb's Book of Life, from the Garden of Eden, clear up unto 1844. Okay? Now, do you say the prophecy must be fulfilled by one person? We answer, not necessarily. For the cause of John was showing us that it is not the individual but the spirit and power that fulfills the prophecy. Well, maybe that is so in our day. Let's just ferret this out and see what conclusion we come to here. And why may not this spirit and power accompany a body of men as well as a single individual, especially if the magnitude and importance of the work demands such an increased agency? Review and Herald, February 23rd, 1864. Well, I agree with that assessment, but, you know, you still have to have one main head that the visions have to be given to, just like they were given to Ellen G. White as the number one main head. She got all the visions, nobody else did. It was just Ellen G. White that received over 2,000 visions and dreams. Now, if what she is saying is true here, then, it looks like that she's trying to say, well, this, when this Elijah comes, it don't have to just be one person, it could be a whole bunch of them. Well, I don't agree with that. No more than I agree with her, or I'm wanting to lend her visions to hundreds of other people and say, well, you can have visions just like me. No, no. That won't happen until after the day of Pentecost, in our day, the antypical Pentecost, when the Spirit is pouring out without measure up on all of those who has their names in the Lamb's Book of Life. And you find that in Joel chapter 20, chapter 2, I believe, 2:23-28. Okay, let's continue on now. We say then that we believe that the third angel's message is now completing the fulfillment of the Malachi 4, 5, and 6. Hence, let none be beguiled with the fancy that Elijah is yet personally to appear. But give heed unto the work already going on before their eyes. Review and Herald, February 23, 1864. Italics ours. For the founders of the denomination are here seen unquestionably to discredit the idea of the ancient prophet's personal reappearance. Moreover, these passages say that though the prophecy itself does demand an individual prophet, it does not restrict the work to an individual, but to a group, unto a body of helpers directed by the Yahweh and endowed with the Spirit. Well, let's see. How many helpers did Elijah the Tishbite have on the day that he went up to Mount Carmel to meet Ahab? Now, Ahab, he had all the helpers on his side. He had 850 false prophets, he had 7,000 in Israel that hadn't bowed the knee to Baal that was sitting out there in the audience, looking at this, watching this drama unfold. They're on Mount Carmel with Ahab and Jezebel, or Jezebel wasn't there, but Ahab. And he had all of Israel. And there's one lonely little old man named Elijah, and he had the father's name, Eliyahu. And he came from Gilead, he came from down south, came from east, south, west, whatever. And he came in to the north, he came into Mount Carmel, and he had a date set there. One lonely man against the whole nation of Israel. Alright, now, Ellen G. White says, now, when this Elijah comes again, it's not necessarily just one man, it could be a whole bunch of helpers with him. Well, Elijah in the type didn't have not one helper. Only helper he had was those unseen multitudes of angels that were looking on, and very close by, but you couldn't see them. He had all heaven there as an audience. He had Yahweh and the Son, Yahweh the Father and the Son there as on his side, but they were invisible. Abraham had to exercise 100% faith in what he was doing. But he was empowered with heaven by the Spirit. So likewise, it's going to be the same way today. This Elijah that it says, points out there in Malachi 4, verse 5, that he's going to come before the great and dreadful day of the Yahweh and said, this is one man. This is one man. Okay. So now it says, these quotations are further elucidated by the early writings. I then saw the third angel and said, my accompanying angel, fearful is his work, awful is his mission. He is the angel that is to select the wheat from the tares and seal or bind the wheat for the heavenly garner. Now, Ellen G. White, she said she's shown this in early writing. But the truth of the matter is, as we understand inspiration now on the subject of the three angels, that how could this third angel do all these things and have never touched down here on the earth? Those three angels were seen flying in the midst of heaven, and they never once made it to the earth. But there is two other angels there in Revelation 14 that follows the three angels, and they made it to the earth. Both of them. The sealing angel of Revelation 7 made it to the earth. And he's the one that has the commission to seal. The third angel don't have no commission to seal anything, because they never made it to the earth. Alright, these things should engross, Ellen G. White says, these things should engross the whole mind, the whole attention. Early writings, page 118. In this quotation, we are plainly told that the third angel's message and its final phase is the harvest, the judgment for the living. Okay, now what's wrong with all of that? What's wrong with all this? We got words that are left out by the translators. We got words that was left out by Ellen G. White because she didn't know to put them in there to begin with. Let's read this, adding the missing words. Let's read it again. In this quotation, we are plainly told that the third angel's message in its final phase, you mean the third angel's message has a beginning phase and a final phase? Well, what about the first two angels? Did they have a beginning phase and a final phase? Well, maybe they did. But let's just see. Let's see when we add the words, though, that are missing. Let's go ahead and read that again. He said, in this quotation, we are plainly told that the third angel's message in its final phase is in the harvest. Now, Ellen G. White left out the preposition in. She said, is the harvest. Well, the third angel don't harvest anything to begin with. But if the third angel is in its final phase, then it had to be joined in by the fourth and fifth angel, because they're the ones that are with the sealing angel, and they're the ones that are empowered with the Pentecostal power to throw the three angels' messages into a loud cry, but it is done by the fifth angel, fourth and fifth angel. The third angel has nothing to do with it. Okay? So it says, what was the third angel's message to begin with? Not to take the mark of the beast. That's all it was. Don't go back and take the mark of the beast. That's all it had to say. That's all the message he had was don't take the mark of the beast. That's the only message he had. The judgment for the living again. Okay, now it says, in its final phase, the third angel is in the harvest time, in the judgment for the living time, period. In the 12th parabolic lesson, parabolic hour, which is your 12th hour that we're in now. So she didn't know anything about the last parabolic hour. She didn't even know what parabolic hour she was in. She was called at the ninth hour there on the parabolic time clock. She was called at the ninth hour, but she didn't know how to interpret that, because she was called when the ninth hour was coming to its end. So she ended up working in the 10th parabolic hour, and that's all. But she didn't know what hour she was in for the advent. Okay. It's like V.G. Hollis that followed her in 1930 with the rod. He didn't know what hour he was in. He was also in the 10th hour, but he didn't know it. He thought he was in the 11th hour, and he thought the 11th hour was the last hour on the parabolic time clock. And yet the parabolic time clock shows that there's 12 hours, not 11 in the day. To back up what John 11:9 says, are there not 12 hours in a day? Work while you have the light? Well, Ellen G. White worked in the 10th hour. The Shepherd's Rod worked in the 10th hour. And then the one that succeeded the Shepherd's Rod, Rutherford W. Johnson, in 1970, the one that I joined, went to work in the 11th hour and worked in the 11th parabolic hour. And yet Rutherford Johnson taught that the 11th parabolic hour was the last hour. He taught that he was going to be the one to bring in the harvest. But he wasn't teaching the third angel's message. He was teaching the fifth angel's message. And the fourth, the sealing angel, Revelation 7. He wasn't teaching the three angels. Because it wasn't in the three angels' message. The harvest message is not found in the three angels' messages. Let us go ahead. It says, for the time of the judgment is a most solemn period, when the Yeshua gathers his own from among the tares. Testimony of Ministers, page 234. For the third angel's message, in his former phase, the judgment for the dead was unfolded to the Seventh-day Adventists by the one person, Ellen G. White. Okay, that's in his... you know how long the judgment of the dead lasted? You know how long the judgment of the dead lasted? It lasted for 158 years, from 1844 to 2002. So that's the first phase of the three angels' messages. Or when the third angel's message finally, in its final phase, came to an end in 2002, the Adventists didn't even know it. Elijah David, speaking to you right now with the office of inspiration, as a prophet in the spirit and power of Elijah, but this was revealed to him, 2002. I was there when it happened. Alright, so it says, the third angel's message in his former phase, the judgment for the dead, was unfolded unto to the denomination by the one person, Ellen G. White, as the founder of the Seventh-day Adventist, and that one directed other, and that one, Ellen G. White, directed other laborers, or co-laborers, so must it be with respect unto the message in its latter phase, the judgment for the living. Now, when Ellen G. White started her mission, she had a partner, and that was her husband, James White. She had a few elders that came out of the Millerite movement that joined her. All right enough. But they didn't have the office of inspiration with her. They didn't share the office of inspiration. Her husband tried to share the office of inspiration with her. He wanted to, but Yahweh didn't give that to him. She had it alone by herself. Now, once she had the truth unfolded, she could convey the truth unto others. And if they want to convey that same truth unto others, that's fine. That's what makes them co-laborers. But they have to wait to get their orders from headquarters. First, they have to get their message from the Office of Inspiration. They have to come in every morning and come to the Office of Inspiration where Ellen G. White was to get their daily message, and then they go out and pass it on. That's the only way that they could teach the truth, present truth. That's the only way it always has been. All right. So it says, moreover, since the first part of the third angel's message, the judgment for the dead, neither comprises the last message nor ends the judgment, but instead covers only the first phase of it. In the last part of the third angel's message, the judgment for the living. Oh, so he's saying the last phase of the third angel's message is the judgment, is a message for the judgment of the living. Ellen G. White says that you've got to add that fourth and fifth angel to those three angels, or you're left without a rule to interpret that chapter. They're in the Word of the Little Flock, page about 10. It says, with a subtitle entitled, Thoughts on Revelation 14. Okay. So it says, Then the last part of the third angel's message, the judgment for the living, is necessarily the last message and the final phase of the judgment. So, threefold message. But that was only for the Adventists, for the whole judgment of the dead. The three angels only was involved in the period of the judgment for the dead, from 1844 to 2002. And then the fourth and fifth angel are put in charge then of the harvest message. And they're with a new movement, and they're with a new name and a new inspiration. A whole new setup of a whole new kingdom organization. The kingdom now is finally coming into view as an organized instrument. Brother Johnson started in 1970 by restoring the sanctuary service back to its rightful order by the creation calendar that was given unto him, to put the house of Israel back on the true time and establish true worship by the restoring all divine institutions that Ellen G. White prophesied about there in Prophets and Kings, page 678. In fact, the three angels' messages are applicable unto the judgment for the dead only indirectly. Well, I say wrong. They're applicable to the judgment of the dead directly, because that's what started the judgment of the dead, the announcement of the third angel in 1844. See, this here play on words by these prophets that have inspiration. V.T. Hollis had inspiration, and he wrote this. And it's wrong. It's just wrong as it can be. But nevertheless, that's what my job is to correct all these here misnomers and errors and these misquotes and so forth. For the judgment for the living is the all-important event, that is, the angel is not sent particularly to explain what the judgment does unto the dead, but what it is to do unto the living. Well, the third angel only had charge of the judgment of the dead. The fourth and fifth angel that made it to the earth, they have the charge of the judgment of the living here on earth, because they orchestrate its success. It orchestrates the office and puts all the players in the right place to accomplish the work. This magnanimous work that has to be done here in this 12th parabolic hour of the judgment of the harvest, judgment of the living, here in the 12th parabolic hour. A whole new movement, a whole new kingdom set up. The Adventist Church kingdom comes to a complete end once 144,000 are separated from her bowels. Revelation 14:1. When that happens, that's when the whole Adventist Church then fulfilled that prophecy in Zechariah 4:7. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, the governor of Judea, which happens to be Elijah David, thou shalt become a plain. And that's the one I'm speaking to you now, right now. Elijah David is this antitypical Zerubbabel as well. For the judgment for the dead, furthermore, is not the message of the great and dreadful day. It does not even touch on the prophecies of the great and dreadful day of the Yahweh. So, then therefore, what's the third angel doing? Coming forward now, and people, and the prophet saying she's got to have her say again. No, she's already had her say. 158 years she's had her say. Now it's time for the fourth and fifth angel, filled with the Pentecostal power from a purified church. And since the one by whom the message of the judgment for the dead was unfolded has already been dead these many years, and since nothing, not to mention all things, has as yet been restored. Okay. And two, since that one never claimed to be the Elijah, okay, nor to unfold the prophecies of the judgment for the living, No one, therefore, can honestly and innocently say, Elijah has already come and gone. In view of these facts, it would be stupidity of the lowest form, if not blasphemy, for anyone to lay such charges to her or to imagine that her prophetic office fulfilled anything more than a preparatory part of the mission of Elijah. So we see that the more we consider the subject, the more obvious becomes the truth that the third angel's message in its final phase is the judgment for the living, the harvest. Plainly, the work of Elijah is to give light on the judgment for the living. Hence, so Vitalis believing that he was this Elijah back there in 1930, he died in 1955, he believing that he was this Elijah and that the third angel's message is going to do all these things. So he's without Pentecostal power. He's without the sealing angel of Revelation 7. He's without the judgment angel of Revelation 18. It comes down like the whole earth, and that's the fifth angel that fills the whole earth with glory and starts the slaughtering of Ezekiel 9 that goes through the Adventist church. See? That's not in the three angels' messages. Those who are to prepare the way for the second coming of the Yeshua are represented by the faithful Elijah. As John came in the spirit of Elijah to prepare the way for the Yeshua's first advent. Testimony, Volume 3, page 62. Very obviously, the letter of the sins cannot possibly prepare the way for the Yeshua's second advent without the message of the judgment for the living, the last. And besides, they themselves declared Yeshua are on the verge of being declares to Yahshua, the later sins are on the verge of being spewed out. Necessarily then, the later sins themselves are, if possible, to be awakened by the prophet Elijah. And that was my job in 2002 at Kermit, Texas, to awaken the prophet there and the congregation of Gilead Center, Kermit, Texas, 2002, starting at the Passover. But it didn't work. But it was attempted. This, while dreaming of being rich without his message, they perish in their sin and thus abide not in the judgment. That's what happened. We had our judgment against the house of Yahweh, and Ezekiel started with the ancient men for the house and started the house of Yahweh, 1 Peter 4:17. Ezekiel 9:6 said it was the ancient men for the house. Here is Sister White's own prophecy of the work during the great and dreadful day, that when she wrote was yet future. For the closing words of the Malachi are a prophecy regarding the work that should be done preparatory unto the first and second advent of the Yeshua. Okay, that's Southern Watchman, Ellen G. White, March 21st, 1905. For the work of John the Baptist and the work of those who in the last days go forth in the spirit and power of Elijah to arouse the people from their apathy are in many respects the same. His work is a type of the work that must be done in this age. Yeshua is to come. The second time to judge the world in righteousness. So that's what he started the judgment for in 1844, was to get all the righteous separated from the wicked in the books of the records, starting with the dead, for the messengers of the Yahweh who bear the last message of the warning to be given unto the world are to prepare for the Yahshua's second advent as John prepared the way for his first advent. Southern Watchman, March 21st, 1905. In the hour of the greatest peril, the Elohim of the Elijah will raise up human instrumentalities to bear a message that will not be silenced. Prophets and Kings, page 187. Yet having God, prophecy must be fulfilled. Yahweh says, Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Yahweh. Somebody is to come in the spirit and power of the Elijah. And when he appears, men may say you are too earnest. You do not interpret the scriptures in the proper way. Let me tell you how to teach your message, testimonies, and ministry. Page 475, 476. Quoted from the Review and Herald, February the 18th, 1890. This is the greatest danger of all, even of believers. Thus plain it is, indeed, that we have more to fear from within than from without. The hindrances to strength and success are far greater from the church itself than from the world. Review and Herald, March the 22nd, 1887. To say the least, those who are within should know better than to tempt themselves to study the ark, as though Elohim had appointed them to take his place and to direct his prophet, coveting not only the prophetic office, but Yahweh's authority as well. What an insult, not only unto the one's own intelligence, but also to Elohim himself. From the light now streaming forth on this subject, you can see, brethren, as never before, that we have come to life's most serious hour, a time that we can no longer treat this matter lightly and indifferently, but that we must ask Elohim for the leading us into his truth for this time. Lest we blindly without inspiration walk on to doom. And the more earnestly still should this solemnity be laid to the heart as one views these next weighty words to the church. In the last solemn work, few great men will be engaged. They are self-sufficient, independent of Yahweh, and he cannot use them. Yahshua has faithful servants who in the shaking testing time will be disclosed unto you. Testimony, Volume 5, page 80. For the messages from heaven are of a character to arouse opposition. For the faithful witnesses, for the Yahshua and the truth will reprove sin. Their words will be like a hammer to break the flinty heart, like a fire to consume the dross. There is constant need of the earnest, decided messages of the warning. Yahweh will have men who are true unto duty. At the right time, he sends his faithful messengers to do a work similar to that of the Elijah. Testimony, Volume 5, page 254. Only those who have withstood and overcome temptation in the strength of the Mighty One will be permitted to act a part in the proclaiming of the third angel's message, when it shall have swelled into the loud cry. Review and Herald, November 19, 1908. Brethren, what these pages here bring unto you to leave in your hearts for your most earnest prayerful consideration is not a theory, not someone's idle tale, but is of the inspiration itself. It can only therefore be the truth. Consequently, your giving heed unto it should make you exceedingly happy. If there is, however, any doubt, then I ask you, please, to produce your cause. Show us what else must these prophecies and parables mean. Do not brush them off by saying, offshoot, or by pinning on them some other uncomplimentary label. For the longer you do this, brethren, the more you will torment yourselves. I implore you to write unto the Universal Publishing Association, not Carmel Center, Waco, Texas, for the free literature on the message for the hour and study it thoroughly. Get down to business in all candor and solemn seriousness. You will not then be troubled with the offshoots any longer. I guess. So before you speak your mind, brethren, please consider carefully what time of truth will you have for yourself and for the world after judgment for the dead is over, if you reject the revelation herein? And what will you have for anyone, including yourself, when the judgment for the living began? But an empty lamp, unless you now get the extra oil in your vessel, unless in other figures the scroll unrolls and another divinely revealed truth, meet in due season, Matthew 24:45, be given you. And what would happen if you should copy the mistakes of the Jews, the Romans, and the Protestants who have rejected the messages of Yahweh? Elohim forbid it be the fearful fate of any unto whom this appeal is addressed. Okay, this brings us to the close of our study. This hour contacts us at the 11th hour call. Actually, we have 15 more minutes left on this tape. Let's go to Mount Zion at the 11th hour, track number 8 of Viti Hara. We're on page 20, entitled, The Church Must Be Purified. No Christian of any faith can honestly deny the church's need of the purification. And, as Yahshua never does anything without forewarning his church, he is now sending to her the message of the purification in order to give her a foretaste of the future glory, so that as heaven's clarion call unto the Reformation continues sounding forth among his people, they may have a keen relish for its truth, and may give themselves wholeheartedly to the work of the reform. Right now, while he is clearly laying before them his plan for the setting up of his kingdom with the consequent results unto the sinners, those who give implicit heed unto the call shall have an irresistible desire to come fully into line and to have the Yahshua separate them from sin and sinners. They alone shall receive the seal of Elohim, and as the first fruits of the kingdom, the 144,000 strong, stand with the Lamb on the Mount Zion. Such a state of the holiness will today, just as in the past, cause the dragon to be wroth with the woman, also now to make war with her remnant, Revelation 12:17. A conflict which is further described in the words, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth at the time of the sealing of the 144,000, a hole in the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living Elohim, and he cried with a loud voice unto the four angels unto whom it is given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of Elohim in their foreheads. Revelation 7:1-3. Here are brought to view two hurtings about to take place, one by the winds, the other by the angels. And two commands unto the angels, one that they restrain the winds, that the winds blow not on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. Revelation 7:1. For the other, that the angels refrain themselves from hurting the earth, sea, and trees, till the servants of Elohim are sealed, Revelation 7:2-3. Since therefore, as soon as the servants of Elohim are sealed, both the saints and the angels will begin to hurt, the question arises as to what the work of the winds and the work of the angels represent, political strife or something else. As the nation have always been at war, these twofold work of hurting could not represent political strife, and as Yahshua said, that at the time of the end, nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, Matthew 24:7. It is clear that the hurting by the winds also, the hurting by the angels, both of which are kept back until the 144,000 are sealed, must be figurative of the holding back the time of the trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, Daniel 12:1. According to Yahweh's refraining of the four winds is his holding back the image of the beast activity. Revelation 13:15-17. Against the saints, while his restraining the four angels that they hurt not, is his holding back the executing of his vengeance. Isaiah 63:1-4. Jeremiah 51:18. Upon the sinners who trouble the church until after the siege of the 144,000 is completed. Being coupled, these two hurtings bring the time of the trouble such as never was. Revelation 7:1-3. Therefore reveals a twofold conflict. Wicked men against Yahweh, the blowing of the winds, and Elohim against them, the angels hurting them. But though the blowing of the winds and the hurting of the angels after the servants of the Elohim are sealed, will bring the time of the trouble. Yet every one that shall be found written in the book shall be delivered. Daniel 12:1. From these facts we see that this time of the trouble is held back in the order for the safeguard safeguarding of the sealing of the 144,000 servants, lest they, the very elect, be brought down to worship the image of the beast, or be killed for refusing. Since in the Revelation all the books of the Bible meet and end, the Acts of the Apostles, page 585, the sealing of the servants of Elohim, Revelation 7, must necessarily be found also in the prophecy. In Ezekiel chapter 9 is envisioned the marking of those who sigh and cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof, in Judah and in Israel, and the slaughter of those who do not thus sigh and cry. And the fact that Elohim has at no time taken the sinners from among the righteous in Judah and in Israel shows that this prophecy of the purification by the slaughter has never been fulfilled. So therefore, as the marking is the same as the sealing, the angels slaying is the same as the angels hurting. This hurting and sealing which John saw, and the slaughter and marking which Ezekiel saw, are again identified as one and the same. This sealing of the servants of Yahweh is the same that was shown unto Ezekiel in vision. Testimonies of Ministers, page 445. Testimonies, volume 5, page 211, and volume 3, page 267. Although the marking and the slaughter, Ezekiel 9, include only the church, Judah, and Israel, the hurting by the winds and the hurting by the angels, Revelation 7, include all the world, both the earth and the sea, each of which is indicative of a different locality. The sea and the realm of the nature, the storehouse, home of the waters, is therefore in the realm of the symbols, the birthplace of the nations, the old country, the earth, the opposite of the sea, is correspondingly a domain away from the old country. It is located under John in the symbol of the two-horned beast coming up, and not out of the sea, but out of the earth, the United States, in other words, Revelation 13:11. The only place where trees naturally grow, and as according to Daniel 4:20-22, trees are figurative of rulers. Therefore, the trees in this instance represent the ancient man before the house, Ezekiel 9:6. A fact which reveals that in this period the church's headquarters are in the two-horned beast dominion, the new world, the earth. In the light of the clear but cut facts before us, we see that the main object of the sealing or marking of the servants of Elohim is to cleanse the church from sin and sinners, so that she may be able to stand strong against the image beast in the time of the trouble, and that when this purifying work is completed, it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem, when the Yeshua shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. Isaiah 4:3-4. When this special work of the purification of the putting away of sin among Elohim's people is accomplished, then the church is to enter upon her final conflict. fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners. She is to go forth into all the world, conquering and to conquer. Great Controversy 4:25, Prophets and Kings 7:25. For the Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place of the Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud and a smoke by day and a shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defense, and there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge and for a covert from the storm and from the rain. And they shall call them the holy people, the redeemed of the Yahweh, and thou shalt be called sought out, a city not forsaken. Isaiah 4:5 and 62:12. Okay, it says, the entire congregation action is one, blended in perfect union. It is to be a living, active missionary agency moved and controlled by the Holy Spirit. All that the apostles did, every church member today is to do, is workers will then see eye to eye, and the arm of Yahweh, the power of which was seen in the life of Yeshua, will be revealed. Testimony, Volume 8, page 47. Volume 7, page 33. Volume 9, page 33. Then it shall come to pass, saith Yahweh, that I will sanctify my great name, which was profaned among the heathen, which you have profaned in the midst of them, and the heathen shall know that I am the Yahweh, saith Yahweh Elohim, when I shall be sanctified in you before their eyes, for I will take you from among the heathen and gather you out of all countries and bring you into your own land. Then will I sprinkle clean water upon you, and you shall be clean from all your filthiness, from all your idols, and I will cleanse you. A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you, and I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you an heart of flesh, and I will put my spirit within you, and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you shall keep my judgments and do them, and you shall dwell in the land that I gave unto your fathers, and you shall be my people, and I will be your Elohim. I will also save you from all your uncleanness, and I will call for the corn, and will increase it, and lay no famine upon you, and I will multiply the fruit of the tree, and increase the field, that you shall receive no more reproach of famine among the heathen. Then shall ye remember your own evil ways, and your doings that were not good, and shall loathe yourself in your own sight, for your iniquities, and for your abominations. Not for your sakes do I of this, saith Yahweh Elohim, be it known unto you, be ashamed and confounded for your own ways. O house of Israel, thus saith Yahweh Elohim, in the day that I shall have cleansed you from all your iniquities, I will also cause you to dwell in the cities, and the ways shall be built. Then the heathen that are left round about, you shall know that I, the Yahweh, build the ruined places and plant that was desolate. I, the Yahweh, have spoken it, and I will do it. Ezekiel 36:23-33 and verse 36. This brings the close of our study. You can contact us at the 11th hour call, and that's number 11. Click on our audio archive, hear this message, and more. We're going to close now with a song. End of our study. I'm going to close this service now with a song that I've written entitled Dusty Roads and Sandal Feet. I have reason to believe in that man of Galilee, for he walked those dusty roads to you and me. Oftentimes they took his burden all along as he journeyed along that road to Calvary. Dusty roads, sandal feet, oh, the journey was complete from the manger to the cross. Through the golden streets to a place in the land where someday we all shall meet. Turn up the stormy, dusty road and sandal feet. I have reason to believe in that man of Galilee, for For there's nothing in this world it couldn't do. Send the water and to wine, touch the demons, heal the blind. And that's why I believe in the Grand Calvary. Dusty road for his companion, desert places, his abode. Sandal feet were often weary underneath a heavy load. Never complaining as he went along the way, on the way to the Calvary and the Judgment Day. Dusty road, sandal feet, how would you like to meet that man in Yashua? Coming down your street, would you be like Zacchaeus, some kind of man or two? Or would you be like Jonah, who wanted to be? Dusty roads, sandal feet, all the journey was complete, from the manger to the cross, through the golden street, to a place in the plain where someday we all shall be. Author of the story, Dusty Roads and Sandal Feet, the author of the